Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
On ABC Radio National, this is Artworks. Hello, I'm Amanda Smith. And once again, I've got festival fever. You don't have to be very old to remember a time when a big, exciting arts festival in Australia meant Adelaide every 2 years or Perth. Now, of course, every major city in the country's got one. The same sort of growth has happened globally too. Cities all over the world have or want to have an international arts festival to call their own. And later in the hour, we'll talk about why. But first to the festival that's on right now, the Melbourne International Arts Festival, and a couple of the shows that opened it. It's the old story. Two people fall in love. They want to spend the rest of their lives together. But there are family objections. This is the scenario for one of the shows at the Melbourne Festival, a pretty standard plot for a love story. But in this play, the star-crossed lovers are in their 80s and they're in a nursing home. It's called Half-Life and it's performed by Necessary Angel Theatre Company from Canada. Now, the idea of a romantic sexual relationship between two people in their 80s who are in an old folks' home, well, maybe it's not the sort of love affair you imagine you'd want to see on the stage. And how is a play that's also about memory loss and ageing not depressing? Daniel Brooks is the director of Half-Life.
Well, one of the premises of the play is that life goes to the very end, and that it is possible to find love late in life. There's a beautiful speech in the play where a reverend who is contradicting a scientist's view that we can create artificial life, he takes issue with that and says, well, why call a machine life? He goes on to explain that there's something about He compares people to weeds. Weeds, when they age, can become beautiful. They have such a wide variety of colors that they express. And then he says that people are the same as they age. They can express their essences in so many different ways. And there's a tremendous beauty in that. And he says, for lack of a better word, he uses the word soul to describe what that essence is. It's not depressing. In fact, one of the major themes in the play is what constitutes human personality and what constitutes what we are. And it's not depressing, I think, to face with certain amount of wit and delicacy questions that we all live with every day, which is that our lives are finite and everything that we do is finite.
Well, at first in this play, you think that it's going to be about the two middle-aged children mm-hmm. of these elderly people in the nursing home. You think that they're the ones who are going to fall in love when they meet in the nursing home. And relating to what you were saying about the idea of finding your essence as you age, it's their parents who do seem to be more willing to throw themselves into mm-hmm. the moment than these two middle-aged divorced children who seem completely unable to form a relationship.
Yeah. One of the central ideas in the play is that the older woman, whose name is Clara, and she's very deliberately named for her clarity, her moral and personal clarity.
Even though, as we're told by her son over and over, her mind is going.
Yes. Mm. Her mind is going, but it goes to places, and wherever, whatever place it's in, it's very clear. It may not be attached to the present in a conventional way, but it's always very clear. And her grace touches everybody in the play. So this guy who arrives in the nursing home, he drinks, he smokes, he's a womanizer, he's a liar, and he's used to a life of, he comes from special services in the army, he's used to a life of deception and lying. And even he is touched by her grace. And that grace is something that partially comes of age.
Tell us about the playwright, who we're not so familiar with, I guess, in Australia, John Myton.
John is a John has become a mathematician in his years of playwriting. He wrote a lot of plays that they're very difficult to produce because they're very sparse and poetic texts that leave the staging to the director. And he creates enormous challenges for you to stage. And not only that, he demands so much of his actors. He demands an intelligence. He writes intelligent characters who have very subtle wit, and yet they're very repressed. And so you have to be on stage and be very alive, and yet you have to be very subtle, and you can't show too much emotion. And so his plays are so delicate that they're very hard to produce. So
you say he was a playwright who became a mathematician, mm-hmm. not a mathematician who became a playwright.
That's correct.
Well, certainly mathematics and science more generally, ideas about artificial intelligence come into this play. How does the term half-life, which is another scientific term, how does that relate as the title of this play?
Well, one of the central themes in the play is that what we forget defines us as much as what we remember.
I find that such an intriguing idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the fact is that in any given moment, we can't have this conversation unless we forget almost everything we've ever experienced. I mean, certainly there's a background and a learnt consciousness, and there's so much we have learnt, and our brains function in a certain way. But in order to have a conversation, you forget. Your senses forget a substantial amount of what our eyes and ears and our skin perceives. We get rid of that information in order to focus on a particular task. So half-life is partially, the metaphor is drawn from the disintegration of the
radioactive substances. Yeah.
And it refers partially to memory, which disintegrates through life. But it also refers to people who are not living their lives fully. And I think the playwright's kind of melancholic point of view is that we all have this problem of not being able to fully live our lives because, for various reasons.
There's also in this play, I guess, some questions that remain unanswered. I mean, in the plot, there's certainly one that we're never quite sure if Patrick and, I have trouble saying Clara, I want to say Clara, mm-hmm. I'll try and say Clara. We're not sure if they've met before. Clara thinks they have, mm-hmm. but, you know, in her somewhat addled state, we don't really know. That's another intriguing plot line, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have my own theories as to what that is, but I was a huge fan of Northrop Frye, a Canadian cultural critic and a very important writer. I was attending a lecture of his, and he was asked, why does Hamlet delay? And his response was, if Hamlet didn't delay, it would be a very short and pointless play. And part of what I took from that was that a character in a play is a poetic construction. There's no real character, so there's no real past. It's an invented past, which is, I think, the theatrically, the metaphor of an invented past relates to how we invent our own pasts. So whether it actually happened or not is not, it's the intrigue, the question is more important than the answer, I guess.
And another play on memory.
Mm-hmm.
You look familiar.
I'm Patrick. We're playing cards. It's your turn to bid.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. It didn't get anything that looks vaguely like it should look.
So, what are you making it?
Whose card is that?
Yours.
Could have picked it up, but I didn't.
What are you making trumps?
What did you say your name was?
Patrick.
I knew a Patrick once, during the war. He used to take me dancing.
I was never much of a dancer.
Neither was he. Is it my turn?
Yes.
Whose card is that?
Yours.
I always loved to dance, ever since I was a little girl. I could have been a professional dancer, but my parents couldn't afford to give me lessons. Of course, Dad was on the railroad. Now, he was a good Presbyterian. He had three nuns in the waiting room. Oh, my life is... I've done the best with what I had. Whose turn is it?
Yours.
Well, I've no doubt, Daniel, that probably every interview you or members of this cast have done about this play lately asks, you know, what's with the interest in old age, especially in Canada? I mean, this play in Melbourne coincides with the release
Away
in Australia.
From, yeah.
Yes, the film Away From Her, which is adapted from the Alice Munro short story.
Yes, and the Julie director Christie. Is very good friends of ours.
Right, and it stars Julie Christie playing a woman with Alzheimer's mm-hmm. who forms a relationship with someone in a nursing home. So what is the interest in old people?
Well, I think that we're probably a generation of artists who feel absolutely licensed to talk about ourselves. And our parents are aging. This play, Half-Life, came out of John's experiences spending about 2 years with his mother as she suffered from stroke and memory loss and eventually died over the course of about 2 years. So it's a very personal meditation on what he experienced in his time with her in the home.
Is old age, though, as far as a love affair in old age, is it kind of one of the last taboos around love? You know, when other obstacles like class or race or even gender are no longer credible barriers in the telling of a love story, is old age it?
I don't know if it's a taboo. That's an interesting question. I don't know if it's necessarily a taboo.
No, but perhaps one of the last...
The last frontiers of romantic exploration.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, and I think that we constantly have the experience when we perform this play all over the world that people are constantly telling us stories of what happened to their parents and love affairs that their parents experienced. And the fact is that once we move through adolescence, there's a certain erotic longing that stays with us all our lives. And in this play, one of the reasons, for instance, that John, I think, has made the actual past ambiguous is to question whether or not it matters. What's the difference between living on an imagined idea and a real idea? I think it's a very important question, and it's one that actually is deeply important to all of us, because the whole notion of romantic love, to what degree is it imagined anyway? To what degree is it a creation of our culture? And these are very interesting questions to engage with.
Daniel Brooks is the director of John Mighton's play Half-Life, a production by the Necessary Angel Theatre Company from Canada at the Melbourne International Arts Festival. And on ABC Radio National, Amanda Smith with you. This is Artworks. And let's swing just across the foyer in the Victorian Arts Centre now to a very different festival opening show, a music theatre spectacle called The Temptation of St. Anthony. It's a collaboration between the American director Robert Wilson, who's a master of design and lighting, and the composer and musician Bernice Johnson Reagan. She's probably best known as the founder of the a cappella group Sweet Honey and the Rock. Both of them are big draw cards at any festival, so working together with this show was bound to attract interest. The Temptation of St. Anthony is based on the epic novel of the 19th century French writer Gustave Flaubert. And among the first night crowd, the Australian newspaper's theatre reviewer Alison Croghan and Peter Tate from La Trobe University's Theatre and Drama program. And they're talking to Deborah McCoy.
The story of The Temptation of St. Anthony is a fairly familiar one. It's known to lots of people through various different guises. Peter Tate, tell us about Anthony's quest, about the various phases that he goes through in this particular production. Is he tempted all along the way by the usual?
He is. It's very beautiful in that there's a kind of flow to the temptation. So at one time it's this very striking woman in a red dress and she is so tempting, and then the next temptation is in food and other sensuous pleasures, although of course Robert Wilson's the master and he doesn't bring it onto the stage literally. He brings it in a very beautifully symbolic way with shapes. So there are shapes of a jug and vessels and the table, and in the end Anthony walks on the table in a way of dispelling it, so he's walking this very narrow line across the middle of the stage. So the temptations flow with the unfolding of as the production moves through.
And do we see this progression in the Saint Alison? Do we see him questioning and questing? Is there a sense in the character of a search, or is he contested?
There's certainly a sense of refusal, isn't there, Peter? He's holding his hand out in a very Egyptian gesture most of the time, refusing everything. But the sense of struggle within Anthony, I think, comes to a climax towards the end, where he's mainly very passive, I think, and everything swirls around him. The stage swirls around him, and there's such a huge cast and incredible costumes and incredible colours. So there is this whole sensual feast. And one of the ironies in it, I suppose, is that all the temptations are expressed through gospel songs. The feast he was tempted with, for example, was the Feast of the Lord. And so there was a kind of puzzlement going on in my head at that point. And then there were things like intellectual vanity, weren't there? And he was accused of being a hypocrite. And there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, but really it wasn't until towards the end that you felt the conflict within Anthony, I think.
So, Peter, throughout this production, the question of religion as a possibility, and a solution, is that explored in this production?
There's a very clear line in the libretto about religion cannot explain everything, and that's a very strong, clear message. And the story itself, I mean, is really about a mystical path within Christianity, which is not the conventional one. So it falls outside, in a sense. It's about going away from community or society to find God, and not trying to make God in the world around you, but to find God within. And I mean, that's a very esoteric tradition, I think, in Christianity, or in a lot of religions. So if you're following it through, I think it's quite clear what's going on, because the music is so powerful, but it's sung very clearly, and you can actually hear the narrative part through the music.
What about this collaboration, Alison? Because you've got Bernice Johnson-Reagan, who is a very political individual, a great feminist, a champion of African-American music, African-American rights, and then you've got Robert Wilson, whose aesthetic is somewhat cooler, slightly more removed. How does it work as a collaborative piece?
Quite brilliantly, I think. I mean, that is a very abiding characteristic of Robert Wilson, is this ability to sit back. You sit back and admire the exquisite spectacle that he creates. And I particularly loved this show because with Bernice Johnson-Reagan's music and passion that's absolutely evident all the way through, and these two things together really absolutely yeah. kind of are electric together, I think. Mm-hmm. There's this such a contrast and such a polarity between them that it makes this total dynamic that's very exciting. Mm-hmm. So you kind of get the best of both worlds. And there's a beautiful moment, I think, where Bernice Johnson-Reagan really has the meaning is where that wonderful bit where the man comes out and said, I knew Jesus, and he was a man just like me, just like you. So out of the desert, Anthony is finding that what matters most is his own humanity and mortality, and that's what leads into the particular kind of... There is a very mystic moment at the end that's you know, asking all those questions about, you know, who are we, where are we going, and all those sorts of things. But it comes right back down to humanity that's embodied in the gospel. I mean, the gospel is such a beautiful... The gospel singing is such a beautiful way of embodying that tension between the spirit and the body and bringing them into this expression.
Well, give us a sense of the look of it, Peter, because, of course, Robert Wilson is famous for his lighting, his ability to use lighting in the most effective and arresting way.
And that is very strongly here. It is extraordinary. It's visually sensuous, and it's almost like you can taste it when you see it. It is so
floods over you. It's quite beautiful, the sharp contrast between the red and the purple and the blue and the green and the sudden shift in the colour. And I think there are a number of other trademarks that are Wilson there. You've got the sort of movement, the circular movement, the hands in the air, the long gowns. You can find this in his other work. There's also a sense of what I would call the way he comes at the stage space, which is different. It's not just a space that performers enter and exit. It's almost like he uses it as part of a processional way. And you get the feeling that the performers have just come onto the stage as part of their procession. And they're still moving in that procession off when they go off. And then they'll circle back and come back on stage. And you have this feeling with his other productions as well, that the movement's somehow continuous. And it has a different feeling about it. He uses the objects on the stage very differently. They are sculptures in their own right, whether there's a chair or, in this case, the most beautiful pile of gold or golden triangle on the stage, and then there was gold coming down. So the objects themselves are very special. All those elements are there. The very strong sense of classic stage design shapes in the actual set itself, which is very classical in this case. Yeah.
So given all of that, this is, you would say, a good piece for the festival, a good opening night show?
It's certainly a specky opening night show, and the audience loved it. I mean, this glorious music and a glorious thing to look at. I mean, just at that level, it is a show.
I think there's a lot to be said for work that you come out of feeling good about, and the whole idea of a joyous quality is there, something that's very beautiful, it's uplifting. These might sound like old-fashioned qualities, but they're actually things we need right now in our world, and in fact, if anything's going to counter the sort of reign of fear that we're in, it's these kinds of events and moments where we can actually get beyond fearful and terrorised into another world, hopefully.
Peter Tate is a professor in the Theatre and Drama program at La Trobe University in Melbourne, and Alison Croghan is a theatre reviewer for the Australian newspaper. The Temptation of St Anthony, a collaboration between director Robert Wilson and composer and musician Bernice Johnson Reagan, was part of the Melbourne International Arts Festival. Amanda Smith with you on ABC Radio National. That production of The Temptation of St. Anthony at the Melbourne International Arts Festival that we were just talking about, it's already been on in festivals around the world over the past 4 years in Germany, Italy, Spain, the USA. It's one of those shows that's on the festival circuit. The idea of a circuit comes from there being really so many of these multi-art form festivals these days, where once Edinburgh was the festival, and in Australia the earliest were Perth and Adelaide, there are now comparable gatherings in cities all over the world. Just this year, new ones started up in Toronto and in Manchester, for example. So why this growth, and is it all good? Fiona Gruber is a Melbourne-based arts writer, broadcaster and festival watcher, not long back from this year's Edinburgh Festival. And Robin Archer has been the artistic director of the arts festivals of Adelaide twice, Melbourne 3 times, Liverpool briefly, as well as being an artistic advisor now to festivals in Dublin and in Toronto, which is where she is at the moment. And I know there are other festivals I've left out, but you get the picture. Fiona, why do more and more cities want to host a big arts festival, do you reckon?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think that, I mean, there are lots of reasons. I think one of them, especially in Europe, is a rebadging of a city that has experienced industrial decline. It doesn't really have much of a heart anymore, and it's trying to sort of re-glamorise itself. There's a whole system over there called Cities of Culture. Glasgow was one, Liverpool was one. That's one reason. And another reason would be that there's a great tourist dollar there. Oh, tourist pound, tourist ruble. I mean, it's a big circuit.
Well, Robin, you've just been involved in establishing a new arts festival for Toronto. What were the major considerations in deciding what direction to take there, and why a new festival in Toronto?
Yeah, well, the Toronto example was interesting. A private entrepreneur came up and said, I've got $6 million, and if you can match that and do it within the next 7 or 8 months, then you can have my $6 million. And so they did. But I can tell you that the ethos of the CEO, Janice Price, who's come from the Lincoln Centre, is precisely that Toronto people, while they've got a fantastic film festival, actually don't have a major arts festival. And she was just aware of so much stuff that the big Toronto, very, very multicultural city, the Toronto audience had never seen. And I think that harks a little bit back to Adelaide and Perth, which were both cloned in the wake of Edinburgh. Basically, it was the isolation of Perth and then Adelaide that said, we never get to see anything. And the good burghers of those cities basically said, had been and seen Edinburgh and said, we want one of those. And so, in a sense, Toronto's been done for that reason. It's bringing a whole lot of stuff that everybody's aware of, but nobody in Toronto's ever got the chance to see. The mother of them all, in a sense, Edinburgh, was actually begun on wholly altruistic reasons, and that was a gesture to world peace. It started very hot on the heels of the end of the Second World War, and it was about reconciliation.
Well, Fiona, how differentiated are these big international arts festivals these days from each other, you know, from Edinburgh, from Singapore, from Barcelona, from Toronto, from Melbourne, etc.? Or are they often presenting a fair bit of the same stuff these days?
There's always a very strong regional or local flavour. The Toronto Festival that you were just talking about, Robin, has a fantastic programme of Canadian performers. In Australia, of course, we all have our local, in whatever city we are, we all have our local performers. They might not be that well known outside a small circuit, but they're very well known within it. I mean, one thing I do notice, though, is that there is increasingly a show that will do the rounds of a festival. For instance, Marble Mind's Dollhouse, which was on at the Edinburgh Festival. That is a reworking of Ibsen's A Doll's House. They use very diminutive male actors and very tall female ones and very small sets. And it was, you know, obviously it was a metaphor, a visual metaphor for the way that women's lives were curtailed. But, you know, that was caused a stir in Edinburgh, but it also caused a stir in Singapore and Brisbane and Adelaide a couple of years ago, Madrid, Jerusalem, Paris. You know, obviously there's a very big circuit. So in some ways, we're seeing things that everybody is seeing. And if you live in Europe and places where cities are closer to each other, it's not a once-in-a-lifetime event. You might think, damn, missed it in Prague, I'll go and see it in Zagreb.
Robin, though, is there, do you think, any kind of problem with this sort of growth of a kind of global festival circuit where a whole lot of these arts festivals are using the same shows?
Well, probably not. I think there's a bit of cleverness that you need to have about that. I mean, if a show is fantastic and it's knocked people's socks off, we know that, you know, great rock and roll, great pop, great films travel the world and delight audiences all over the world. And in some respects, it's the mark of a piece of art, you know, or an artist, a particular contemporary artist. It's sort of the mark of the artist that they've hit the nail on the head. They've actually been able to reach audiences across cultures, often across generations, across languages, etc., etc. And I think that if a festival program handles that discreetly, that is, so that you're not doing identical programs, and you might have one major shared piece, then I think there's actually nothing wrong with that, as long as you surround it with all kinds of different things, maybe connected, maybe thematically related, maybe you get the company to do another one of their works, or you get them to do masterclasses that are exclusive to your town. I think that that's possible, and these days, particularly in Australia, it has to be said that such an enormous amount of the budget goes on just the airfares to get these companies there. It's actually a little bit difficult then to be arguing total exclusivity, and quite often there's a bit of a tussle between the artistic director and the board or the government. Whoever's sponsoring the event wants an exclusive act, and sometimes you really say, well, yeah, it would be great to have exclusive and we can have special things. On the other hand, it does seem crazy to bring something out that very, very few of the rest of Australia can ever see. Now, there are some things that people will always travel for. I guess the classic in the past was Peter Brook's Mahabharata.
In Adelaide, you know, some years ago, yeah. But Robin, what that means, if you don't have that kind of exclusivity for your festival, what you then can't attract is people from necessarily from interstate to your festival, as people travelled to Adelaide to see that Mahabharata because it wasn't on anywhere else, with a number of other shows being on the festival circuit. It means you don't have to travel to a festival, so the tourism, interstate tourism component is probably going to drop.
Yeah, it sort of depends how much you care about the interstate tourism component.
How important is it in Australia?
Well, you don't really necessarily have to have that. I mean, I know a lot of people came from Adelaide to see the McKellen Shakespeare that was on and the Chekhov that was on recently because it was only going to Melbourne. So I think real people, you know, real culture vultures will travel. And I guess the great example is Ring Cycles. You know, there are a heap of people who just run around the world watching every Ring Cycle they can. It's a sort of mad obsession. Does the tourist dollar matter? I don't know what the figures are like now, but when I came into the Adelaide Festival, it was the highest attractor of interstate and international tourism, and it was never more than 15%. It might have been as low as 12 very often and lower than that. And I imagine that's declined even further as more and more places have their own festivals. And I think we who are involved in the arts do have to be terribly careful about saying the festivals are all the same, because we might get bored with it. I might look at, you know, there was a couple of years ago when the Australian festivals did start to look very samey because they were sharing a lot of product together. And I look at it and I'm thinking, oh, God, they're all a bit the same. But the fact is, for the person in that city, and that's, let's say, 85 or 90% of the local audience, they don't have a chance to travel. They won't see it in Europe. And so we've got to be careful that we're not being a bit arts precious in our particularly privileged position. The main thing I think that you have to guarantee is that the stuff is good, that you're not programming rubbish, really, for just because it's fashionable or faddish or it's your particular taste. An artistic director can't hate what they bring, but sometimes you can bring something that you think, oh, it's not quite my taste, but it's probably very good work and probably a lot of people are going to like it.
Mm. On ABC Radio National, this is Artworks and a conversation about the modern-day International Arts Festival with Fiona Gruber, who's a Melbourne-based arts writer and broadcaster, and Robin Archer, globe-trotting festival advisor and a past artistic director of a number of festivals around Australia. Fiona, I was interested to read in an article that you wrote recently for the Times Literary Supplement on this subject of arts festivals, that the one in Manchester has deliberately chosen to, in a way, set itself apart from
other international arts festivals. Tell us about that and how.
Well, yes, it was launched this year, and it badges itself as only putting on new works. And that's a direct riposte to the phenomenon we've just been talking about of a circuit. But all these works at Manchester, presumably if they do well, they will, you know, be coming to another festival. They will be part of a circuit as well. I'm not saying that's at all a bad thing, but as Robin was saying, you know, things can go a bit samey. And I'd like to pick up on a point that Robin made about Ian McKellen and his recent visit to Melbourne. It's interesting because a few years ago, that would have been the classic festival fodder. A big actor with a knighthood coming over.
With the Royal Shakespeare Company. Yeah,
with a couple of very, very well-known plays. It would have had lots of bums on seats from probably quite a very mainstream audience who thought, we've got to see this man and these plays. They don't come often anymore. The trend has changed. I'd be interested to hear what you mean
we're not likely to see those in a festival
programme? No, they're not part of the festival programming. Those kind of, you know, behemoths of the old style of festival don't tend to get programmed.
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of things about that. Of course, festivals at their very best are trying to challenge their audiences and lead them out. And it's been long proven, and this is one of the reasons why everyone now has a festival, is that it's quite acknowledged that people who won't go to something in a foreign language or something a bit left of centre or a bit weird, they won't go as a one-off during the year. Terribly hard to market, but in a festival, people will take a few risks. And therefore, it's beholden upon the festival, the organisation as a whole, and the artistic director who is, for that time, the custodian, the guardian of that festival tradition, to keep challenging people. I feel, certainly, that if you're going to put government money, and there is a lot of government money, into festivals, then it needs to be for things that wouldn't have another chance to come out. Now, as it is, the McKellen Shakespeare, those kinds of things can come on a commercial basis, and that's the way they came.
Fiona, the Edinburgh Festival, which started in 1947, it likes to think of itself as the original and best international arts festival, along with its fringe. With this burgeoning of these kinds of festivals around the world, though, can it still lay claim to that?
No, I don't think it can. I think that what makes Edinburgh Special is the aggregate of having seven festivals all on at the same time in August. Fringe International Festival, Film Festival, though that's moving, Jazz and Blues Festival, Children's Theatre Festival, Science Festival, South Asian Arts Festival, I've probably missed one out. That's what makes it the amazing attraction. But the actual international festival, no, I don't think it is preeminent. And it's interesting because There was a report commissioned last year by the Scottish Arts Council, which had the great title Thundering Hooves, which was supposed to, you know, refer to the huge herds of festival ponies, you know, heading...
trotting around the world.
Yes, trotting around the world, taking the thunder away from Edinburgh. And they've created a new body called Festivals Edinburgh, which is supposed to really harness the marketing and the publicity and to actually create a much more homogenous vision of Edinburgh. Because Edinburgh, I mean, Robin was talking about how the tourist dollar isn't that important, but Edinburgh, it's vital. It's only got 500,000 population, which more than doubles in August. And in the last few years, the Fringe Festival, the attendance has risen 161%. The Book Festival, that's 120%. And accommodation costs have risen 160% in the last 10 years. And I think Edinburgh saw itself as almost dying by its own success. All festivals are now part of an international circuit. There are stepping stones between festivals. And Edinburgh's product might have a strong Scottish content, and it might commission new works. So do all other festivals. Maybe it has a bigger budget, though in fact that was one of the gripes of the report, that it didn't have enough of a budget. And I would argue that it's the fringe that makes Edinburgh the unique event that it is, not the international festival.
although the international festival this year was generally regarded as a great success. I mean, interesting for us too is that the artistic director was Jonathan Mills, the Australian who directed a couple of Melbourne festivals not so long ago. This is Artworks on ABC Radio National. I'm Amanda Smith, talking about arts festivals in Australia and around the world with Robin Archer. After running a number of big festivals in Australia, Robin's an artistic advisor to a couple of overseas festivals now, including one that started up in Toronto earlier this year. And Toronto is where Robin is this week. Also, Fiona Gruber, who's an arts writer and broadcaster and festival watcher. Fiona, you mentioned the strength of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Mostly I think that's because of its focus on new comedy. Adelaide and Melbourne also have big fringe festivals that run alongside the mainstream ones. But has the relationship between festivals and their fringes changed? You know, it used to be that fringe festivals were where you'd often see the more edgy work, often by local performers, whereas in the international festival you'd get the big orchestra, the famous opera, the well-made play. Is that division still the case, or has the relationship changed?
Well, historically, when the Edinburgh Festival started, 8 theatre directors put on plays in sort of defiance of the international festival because they wanted their work put on. And so it was an organic riposte, and it's often seen, you know, traditionally as, you know, the iconoclastic work, the edgy stuff, as opposed to the more staid or the more big ticket thing. Of course, that's completely changed. There's so much edgy stuff and avant-garde stuff in main festivals nowadays that sometimes it blurs the lines. And in fact, to the extent that, you know, there'll be, say, at the Melbourne Festival, for instance, there'll be, you know, a show that will be carried through from the Fringe to the main festival. It's interesting, you know, Adelaide Fringe is a big draw card. Melbourne is, I mean, it as well. I mean, it's based so that it's 90% homegrown. In fact, the Melbourne Fringe started 3 years before the international festival, when it was the Spoleto Festival. It was a genuine and very spontaneous need to have a sort of a coalescence, a critical mass.
Also to get ahead of the game.
Yeah, to have a critical mass of events and performances.
You were talking about Spoleto of Melbourne, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah.
See, I think that's one of the reasons why it took quite a long time for the Melbourne Festival really to start having some roots, because unlike Perth and Adelaide, that sort of grew from very proud affairs. The people were, I was told that at the first Adelaide Festival, the friends of the festival met everybody at the airport and gave them a flower, met all the artists and all the people coming to the festival with a flower. It was very homegrown, with great pride. When Spoleto started, there was a sense, a little bit like the way the festival has started in Toronto, that it was just parachuted in.
Yes, because this was a festival that was, the director was Giancarlo Menotti. It was the third of these Spoleto festivals.
Then Spoleto in Charleston, in the south of the United States, and then into Melbourne. And so while it was a fantastic feast with an eminent artistic director and great things to enjoy, marvellous stuff, there was a sense that people hadn't seen it grow and they were a little bit out of touch. And I think Melbourne grappled with that for quite a long time. Similarly, Sydney had equally kind of fabricated roots, if you like, or non-roots, in the sense that Sydney Festival started when during January there were heaps of tourists around, but shopkeepers, especially in the central business area, found that there were no people coming shopping in January. And so it actually started as an event that would draw local people into the city in that hot, humid month. So both of those, I think, went through quite a long time of trying to put down roots rather than the others, which sort of grew from little proud burger-like seedlings.
Well, there's so many festivals nowadays. This report, Thundering Hooves, estimated, and I don't know quite how they came to the figure, that there were 10,000 festivals worldwide, of which half had international recognition. And you do see, you know, from Shanghai to Singapore to... Well, Singapore's been around for a while, but there are people who very, very, not cynically, but knowingly create a festival from the top down in order to attract tourists and dollars. I mean, I think it's quite funny that Dubai decided just to cut to the chase and have a shopping festival.
And the Dubai Shopping Festival runs from the 24th of January to the 24th of February next year, just in case you're interested. Fiona Gruber is an arts writer and broadcaster and keen festival watcher. And Robin Archer has directed and advised on numerous arts festivals around Australia and internationally. Amanda Smith with you on ABC Radio National. This is Artworks. And let's return now to the festival that's on in Australia at the moment, the Melbourne International Arts Festival. One of the more unusual venues being used for the festival this year is an experimental art space on wheels. Holly Crawford is a conceptual artist based in New York. And as she's previously done in New York, at the Melbourne Festival, Holly Crawford is hosting a couple of events that take place in this very particular venue. One event is all about sound art, the other is all about the art of conversation. And for Artworks, Suzanne Donisthorpe went along for the ride.
Welcome to Radio National. We're sitting in a limousine now, going around the streets of Melbourne, and this is where you are going to hold your salon.
Yes, I will be in the limo for a total of 36 hours over the 9 days with the Sound Art Limo Project. For another 9 hours, I won't be in the limo, I'll just be greeting people, and they'll be in the Critical Conversational Limo Project. And anybody can sign up and participate in either one or both, and they're free projects.
You don't need to pay. It's actually a free event for people to come to.
Yes, they're free events that people can come to and encourage people to come to, and it's a 25-minute ride around. No route. It just depends on traffic and everything, and just ride around Melbourne, and I'll be playing some sound art, and in Critical Conversations, it'll be a host, say Charles Green, Alexi Glass, sort of random with who you get in the afternoon for 1 hour, and refreshments, and it's not a lecture, it's a conversation with everyone.
But there is a catch to this critical conversation in that the people who come can't just be passive audience members. They actually have to contribute, don't they?
It's not a passive audience. It will be videoed in black and white. I'll edit it. They will have to sign a release because it will be videoed. They could go to Google and type in critical conversations in a limo and see some of the New York ones. No, the people didn't know each other. They bonded. They got to know each other. They had a great time. They were laughing. People were saying, oh, they knew each other. No, they didn't.
And what kind of subject matter did they talk about? Was there particular subjects that you chose, or was it the host that came up with the subjects?
My only instructions to them as to this was to keep a conversation going for 1 hour. 8 people, 10 people, that's why the size. That's why I like that space.
Yes, we better describe the limousine because you need to get a mental picture. There's a cocktail bar with
bottles of champagne.
Champagne on ice, and it's white and kind of very plush on the inside, and it's huge.
Yes, it holds max 12 people.
Sitting rather close to, next to each other,
close
in a very cozy little kind of community.
Yes, exactly. And I'm throwing people into a very nice, comfortable space and saying, enjoy yourself, meet other people, talk to other people, have a big conversation. That's what's going on. Play.
And that's very egalitarian and very democratic. But limousines, they always make me think of you know, the elite, the mafia, the sort of exclusiveness of it. It's quite a different, it's an interesting concept.
The mafia, I hadn't thought of it that way. In New York, there's black limousines and the collectors, and they have black limousines or town cars, and they zip from the one art fair to the other. And when I was given the opportunity to do the project, I wanted a white limo because
to differentiate yourself from the mafia
and the collectors, and also played off the white box of the museum space and things like that. And that's why I'm saying, and so it was experimental space of, here it is, it's on wheels, it's something that you not a museum. I didn't have to worry about getting a space. I created my own space.
Do you think the limo is an inclusive place or exclusive place?
Sometimes exclusive things are good. Like a limo is kind of exclusive thing because
it's not a thing that a lot of people get to be in, or it's not something that normally happens, and it's a special experience to, I was doing it so that we could actually enjoy it.
And what kind of things have they been talking about? What sort of issues have come up from that interaction?
Well, Orlan, who recently was in, I believe, in Perth in Australia doing The French Artist, she was really talking about feminism. She's in her 50s, and at the universities she teaches, there are 60 women artists in the MFA programs, and but the time it still is when you get to the galleries and museums, they disappear. There are very few women. So that's one of the issues she was talking about.
And just to explain, Alan is someone who's actually physically altered her appearance by various forms of surgery, but very drastic surgery. It's more than extreme makeover, isn't it?
Oh, yes, she literally did it as a performance, and she, with the plastic surgeon, she has documented the whole thing, and she put these lumps above her eyebrows, which she does in a silver, it's a very alien-like appearance, but she's playing with issues of beauty and those issues. But what she wanted to talk about was women in art and curating and those.
All my life, I against the discrimination, discrimination and exclusion. It's with a woman, and it's possible to beat. It's possible to kill the woman, and to have one house wife, one esclave, comment dire,
a slave.
A slave.
This could also be seen perhaps as a way of educating people about art. Is there a grey line between art education and this art practice, in fact?
A lot of my art practice is on the line. It's also could be considered art in the sense today is very on the edge of a relational aesthetics or relational or connections, which is seen as part of art or conceptual art. The social comment even of the limo itself and how it's used, New York power, you said here, different people using it exclusively if you have a lot of money and you can have a limo or a fancy car and driver, but this is free, and so thinking about it, it's just those different issues.
The lady in the limo, Holly Crawford, who is also the sound art DJ. She has gathered pieces from all over the world to play to passengers, including this piece from artist China Blue about that day in New York City.
She was on the 86th floor of the World Trade Center. That's where her office and studio was. She was late to her office that day and could not handle this. So what she did was take the calls, the air traffic controller calls, the statistics of the building, and she put it all together in a thing called the calls, and it was her way of handling what happened and how she was very lucky that day to be late. The limo driver would tell them, we are just a half a block behind the World Trade Center site at this point. And people had said, oh, or this is the closest I've gotten. And that was in 2005. And these are people from New York. And he kept saying, well, you're in my limo. This is a safe limo. This is the safest place in New York. So it does come up in a certain way.
Does anyone ever stop the limo that isn't actually invited or isn't part of the experiment?
Yes, in New York, because of traffic, it was driving around, and we had a little sign that said, critical conversations in a limo. And this one person, at a stop, tapped on it, and the driver rolled down the window, and he says, I can be critical. Can I get in the limo? But it was full, but we laughed, and he is in on one of the tapes, a little blurb.
Holly Crawford and her Melbourne Festival White Limousine. Great chance to get a free ride in a stretch limo and experience art. In two ways, you can get to ride around with Holly and listen to her sound art, and or you can travel around in the limo with a guest host, a local artist or curator or critic, and talk about art with them as the streets of the city pass you by. Artworks is produced by Deborah McCoy and Suzanne Donisthorpe. Technical production, John Jacobs. I'm Amanda Smith. And you can chase up details of things you've heard in the program today at our website, abc.net.au/rn/artworks. You can send us an email from there as well if you've got a comment or an inquiry.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.